Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. On Monday, Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon announced that the state would become the 17th in the nation to reject several key provisions in the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. Those provisions are the state-created health care exchanges and the expansion of Medicaid to citizens making 133% of the federal poverty level. The governor cited the cost, which her administration estimates at $475 million through 2020, and the overwhelming passage of State Question 756 by Oklahoma voters. But critics of the governor's decision have stated that the actual cost will be far less, as the federal government will pick up 100% of the costs for new enrollees for the first few years and 90% thereafter. More importantly, the decision will leave roughly 131,000 of the state's estimated 600,000 uninsured in a coverage crater, unable to qualify for the state's stringent qualifications for the current Medicaid program, and barred from getting tax credits to buy coverage under what will be a federal insurance exchange in the state. Joining us to talk about the decision is one of those critics, policy analyst for the Oklahoma Policy Institute, Kate Ritchie. She joins me today as my guest on Studio Tulsa. Kate Ritchie, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Governor Fallon on Monday rejected the expansion of Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act, saying that it would cost the state up to about $475 million between now and 2020, and of course also rejected the health care exchanges. There's been a lot of talk about the numbers of what the Affordable Care Act would actually cost the state. She mentioned the number of up to $475 million between now and 2020. Your institute, the Oklahoma Policy Institute, says in 2020 we're probably going to be spending anywhere from $28 to $37 million. Even if you extrapolate that between now and 2020, you're looking at half the cost of the governor. What's the discrepancy in the numbers?
Well, we think that they're based on some pretty flawed calculations. It's not a good assessment of the cost versus the benefits of expanding Medicaid for Oklahoma. So those numbers that we cited are from the state agency that administers Medicaid currently. They estimate that in 2020, that's how much it would cost them to expand, to cover that expanded population, between $30 and $40 million. The first 3 years are 100% funded by federal dollars. So the discrepancy then is
that takes $120 million out of the equation, right?
And then what you're then looking at is a phase down where the state is then expected to pay 10% of the cost, but the federal government continues to pick up 90% of the tab for that expansion population. So our numbers are based on what that agency who administers the program expects to spend, which is only as much as $40 million, which, to put that in perspective, is less than one half of 1% of all state appropriations in a fiscal year.
And in fact, when you look at the Medicaid budget as it exists, it's almost $1 billion now.
Right. It's a much...
So, I mean, $40 million is like 4%.
It's a drop in the bucket in that regard. Not only that, but the governor is not calculating in what the state will be saving by expanding Medicaid. So that healthcare authority also estimates that we will save about $50 million in healthcare costs for the Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse, the Health Department, and the Department of Corrections, which provides currently that same low-income population of uninsured adults that would be covered by the expansion, provides them with services now, and if they were to be on Medicaid, that state spending would be drastically reduced.
So now if you're going to save $50 million and it's going to cost $40 million, that's a $10 million profit. Now,
yeah, there you go.
Now, I know that not everybody who qualifies for Medicaid in Oklahoma, and our qualifications are really, really stringent. Would the expanded number make a difference in what it costs the state?
The cost to the state, if someone enrolls in Medicaid that wasn't previously eligible, it's 100% funded by the federal government.
Now, if you qualified for Medicaid, but you didn't sign up, the state has to go ahead and cover it.
Right. If you're currently eligible for Medicaid now and just, you know, you're not enrolled, that will not have the same match rate as the newly expanded population. However, that's still a federal-state shared responsibility. So there will be some people, there are different estimates as to how many people will sign up, but that will be an additional cost. However, that's unrelated to the Medicaid expansion. We could choose to or choose not to expand Medicaid, and those very same people will be enrolling in Medicaid come 2014 anyway.
I think the rhetoric around this is centered on the fact that we're going to have lots of uninsured people who were eligible for Medicaid but didn't sign up will suddenly sign up, and that's going to cost the state a lot more money. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the eligibility requirements, let's just talk about how you qualify for SoonerCare, which is is Medicaid here in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. SoonerCare, it's like, first of all, if you don't have any dependent children, you don't qualify. It doesn't matter much money, unless you're in a long-term care facility. That's about the only way. But if you don't have children, you can't qualify. Even a family of four, it's something like $500 a month income, you don't qualify for Medicaid.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Rich. It's a common misconception about the Medicaid program. Some states cover a lot of low-income adults. In Oklahoma, Medicaid primarily is an insurance program for people who live with disabilities, for children, for pregnant women, and for seniors. If you're a healthy working-age adult with no dependent children, you're not eligible at all. If you do have dependent children, for a family of three, you'd have to earn less than $7,000 a year as an adult to be eligible. So they're very, very stringent eligibility guidelines. 60% of the people currently on Medicaid in Oklahoma, 60% of those enrolled are children. So the new population that will be covered are working age adults, up to 133% of the federal poverty line. This is what the governor has announced. She would not be opting into that expansion.
And this would be people making, a family of four making maybe $30,000, something about like that?
About $25,000.
$25,000?
Mm-hmm. For a family of three. Yeah, uh-huh. I believe you're right. But if you want to compare what it is now, family of three with children would have to be making $7,000 or less. With the expansion, if we chose to expand Medicaid, it would cover up to $25,000 a year or less, a family of three. So about half of the working age adults in Oklahoma that live below the poverty level are uninsured. So those are adults who are in need of care and having increasingly fewer options where to get that care.
Now, I was looking at also the Insure Oklahoma program, mm-hmm. which is the sort of exchange that we've already sort of set up here in the state. Mm-hmm. And the numbers are pretty low. It's about maybe 30, 40,000 mm-hmm. Oklahomans. And when you look at the people who would be affected by the Medicaid expansion, the numbers are just really small. Like 1.6% of that 30, 40,000 are 100% or less of the mm-hmm. poverty line. 133%, it's maybe another 2 or 3%. It's a very small. So without the expansion of Medicaid, and also with the health insurance exchanges, which will provide subsidies above that new 133% poverty line figure, those folks are in a world of hurt. There's really no help for them.
That's an excellent point, and you've really kind of hit upon the key issue here, is that this is a population of people that, while very small, will be in an incredibly tight spot when it comes to healthcare options. Right now, there's about 600,000 uninsured Oklahomans. Through the ACA, through employer expansions and coverage, through the exchanges, as you mentioned, and the premium subsidies, people earning between 100 and 400% of the federal poverty level will be eligible for tax credits to help them afford health insurance. Below 100%.
133%.
Yeah, 133% is the Medicaid expansion population. Mm-hmm. But between 100% and 400%, you are eligible for premium subsidies.
Oh, so you could actually get premium subsidies in buying private insurance mm-hmm. rather than going Medicaid.
Between 100 and 133%.
Okay.
Those, definitely, that will be a choice. If we expand, that would be a choice for those adults. But what we're left with if we don't expand Medicaid is those folks below the poverty level who don't have insurance, which is, you know, about half of those adults. There's nowhere really to turn for, you know, comprehensive quality health care and health coverage.
My guest today is Kate Ritchie. She's a policy analyst for the Oklahoma Policy Institute. Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon announced on Monday that the state will not expand Medicaid as a part of the Affordable Care Act, and will not also create a state health care exchange. The federal government will set up a health care exchange. Now, how big a difference will the health care exchange being set up on the federal level versus the state level? Will there be a lot of differences, or is it too early to tell? Because there are no federal exchanges yet.
That's a good question. in certain respects, they have to be similar. The statute lays out basic requirements that the exchange functions the exchanges have to perform. And until a state is ready, prepared, or willing to do so, the federal government will do it for them and cover those basic tasks. What states who have chosen to take control over their own exchange have found is that they are able to make mainly cosmetic, but variable things that make it a little more tailored to their state and the needs of their state.
Perhaps maybe small adjustments that might save some money.
Might save some money, might just better suit Oklahoma consumers and businesses and insurers. And with the feedback of local folks and Oklahomans, the federal exchange will also incorporate that feedback, but certainly not to the same degree. It will be a template program. Most of the IT components of it, as you probably know and the listeners may or may not know, it's an online marketplace to buy private insurance. And so it does require some back-end IT components so that when you get online to choose your health plan, you can sort of cash in your tax credit and apply it toward the cost of that plan. So the federal government has built those big pieces so that they can go into the states and help, you know, set that up for them. But they really want the states. This is a state-based marketplace, and the end goal is for states to take control, and that's really the Health and Human Services, the federal agency that is going to be running our exchange, given the governor's decision. They want Oklahoma to take control.
Now, the governor's rejected the healthcare exchange. Now, once it's up and running and a federal exchange, you know, could a state assume the responsibility at some point down the road?
Absolutely.
And in fact, that's probably a goal of the legislature.
It's definitely the goal of the federal agency that is administering the exchange in the short term. And I think what you'll see over time, and the insurers have already indicated this, Blue Cross Blue Shield, one of the biggest providers of private health plans in Oklahoma, they're very supportive of the exchanges, and they're, you know, they're ready for them. So I think what political leadership will find is that the business community and consumers in Oklahoma are ready to take control over the exchange, and that will eventually happen.
Let's go back to the Medicaid issue. We talked about who really qualifies for StudentCare, and it's a pretty small percentage of people at poverty line and below. And let's look at the competitive angles for the state. You know, we keep talking about how the state needs to be in a very competitive business climate. Certainly, the Chamber of Commerce here, the Metro Chamber, has come out for this Medicaid expansion. What's been the reaction from businesses, from doctors, from actual healthcare providers and hospitals?
You know, I think you'll find a range of opinions, depending on which actor you're talking about. For hospitals, the decision not to expand Medicaid is very troubling for most hospitals in the state for a very technical reason. Right now, and since the 80s, I'm not sure exactly which year, but the federal government provides states with large lump sum payments to help hospitals and providers and community health centers kind of deal with the costs of treating uninsured patients. So there's a federal law that prohibits emergency rooms, public hospitals from turning people away who are in need of care. So by law, they cannot turn these folks away.
Now, that pot of money is generally never large enough to actually cover the cost of health care, because you have every people coming in from cold and flu to actual emergency room visits as well as hospital acute care.
Absolutely. It's meant to offset some of those costs. It definitely doesn't offset all of them. But Oklahoma in 2011 received about $36 million in, they're called DSH payments, disproportionate share hospital payments, to help cut down on some of those costs. What's going to happen in 2014, under the assumption that states would choose to expand Medicaid because it is a cheaper option for care for those patients than very high cost emergency room care. So under that assumption, between 2014 and 2019, the amount of money given to those hospitals by the federal government will be cut in half. So the governor's decision not to expand Medicaid and get those low-income adults on a health plan on a much cheaper track for care means that not only can those hospitals and providers not turn those patients away, but now they're not being compensated. There's no offset for that uncompensated care, and our businesses, providers, and hospitals will take on the burden wholesale of caring for our uninsured low-income adults.
And that means higher insurance rates for those with insurance?
Definitely. Providers, the cost will go somewhere. You know, one of the arguments that you see and certainly stated in the governor's decision, and you saw it in the letter that Senator Coburn wrote urging the governor to reject the Medicaid expansion, is the cost argument. You know, we can't afford to do this. And if you really look at the facts and put politics aside, the exact opposite is true. We can't afford to keep going as we're going now. This care that's provided in an ad hoc, sort of urgent, incomplete basis not only is shouldered by hospitals and providers, but it's passed along to the consumer in the form of higher prices at the hospital, in the form of higher premiums. So it's something that private payers and taxpayers are going to continue to pay.
And for the most part, it's acute stabilization. It's not really treatment of the underlying symptoms as you would when you go to, a primary care physician. At the emergency room, it's stabilize you, release you.
Right. So if you don't have insurance and you have any common ailments that we all get from time to time, you go to the doctor if you have insurance and you have a cold or sore throat or some sort of nagging condition. If you don't have insurance, those consumers tend to delay care until they get sick enough that it becomes an issue for their ability to work or maybe even life-threatening, depending on what it is. So it becomes much more expensive to deal with. And even if they don't delay care and they go in just for the sniffles, that appointment at the ER for the sniffles versus your primary care provider is going to cost a lot more.
Of course, for primary care, it's a whole range of options, because I know many primary care providers are seeing uninsured folks, and it's sort of like, what can you provide on a cash basis? Here's what I'm going to get back if I'm billed by my insurance, if you had insurance. And so it's almost a negotiation,
right,
with the primary care physicians.
Absolutely. And that's a big stress on the physicians and on our providers. It's a big stress on those families whose budgets can't stretch. And it ends up hurting not just those uninsured patients financially, but the economy overall. Those unpaid bills end up as debt collections. They ruin people's credit. They come out of the profits of those providers. They lead to less productivity for those adults. I mean, these are working age adults. These are people who are working and earning, but they're not earning enough income to pay for healthcare. So it has an economic impact on the state that is beyond those patients themselves.
Back to the hospitals for a moment, because we talked about the DSH payment. So this is the uninsured sort of reimbursement, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
There are also other changes in the act, which I think hospitals were counting on this expansion of Medicaid to take up the slack. Isn't there going to be some cuts in Medicare reimbursements
mm-hmm.
as a part of this? And the idea was that, you know, more uninsured being insured through Medicaid expansion would maybe ease some of those costs.
Definitely. So the payments that we were just discussing, those DSH payments, are for both Medicaid and Medicare. And hospitals, you know, have come to rely on them. Having those same patients covered by Medicaid is critical. So Medicare is health insurance program for seniors, but one major aspect of the state Medicaid programs, and certainly Oklahoma's Medicaid program, is those dual eligibles, is what they're called. These are folks who are on Medicare, but who are also very low income. And so their needs exceed what basic Medicare plans typically provide, or they spend down their savings and their assets and they, you know, have no real income left and they have healthcare needs. So Medicaid and Medicare both contribute to caring for those people at a vulnerable time in their lives and a time when care is often needed. So
usually the most expensive portion of your
life.
You know, as far as that healthcare costs.
Absolutely. And that is a cost that expanding Medicaid would certainly give hospitals a higher margin of error and cut down on a lot of that uncompensated care for them.
We talked about hospitals. What's the effect on the whole healthcare system? You know, mm-hmm. if we're creating sort of a two-tiered federal system where mm-hmm. some states are going to have most people insured, other states who maybe reject some of these expansions of Medicaid or for whatever reason have more uninsured, mm-hmm. does that create a sort of a competitive gap for attracting good doctors for good healthcare overall for the state?
You know, that's a really good point. It would be hard to say whether or not that would change someone's decision about whether or not to stay in practice medicine in Oklahoma.
Or start a practice
in Oklahoma. We do know now that the state struggles with having enough primary care providers and doctors to serve our population as it is
now. Well, that's also a national issue, too.
Definitely a national issue. And on the continuum of that issue, we struggle significantly. But I do think two things in that regard with this sort of complication it creates when you have some states who do cover their low-income uninsured and some states that don't, and it's the federal government that's picking up the cost share, you have two results. One is that Oklahoma taxpayers are paying for the care of the low-income uninsured for other states. So if we decide...
Through their federal taxes.
Exactly. So the governor has decided not to expand Medicaid and references the federal budget, needing to tighten our belts, so to speak. That has no bearing on whether or not Oklahomans pay income taxes, and many of them do pay and will continue to pay income taxes. All it means if we reject the Medicaid expansion money is that we're paying for other states' health care, and it's not going into our economy. It's not going to hire doctors and nurses here in Oklahoma.
And that's one of the things that has not been talked about a lot with the Affordable Care Act, is the fact that states like ours, which have had very stringent Medicaid requirements, other southern states, Texas, a lot of the South, as a matter of fact, stand to really, really benefit. I mean, a huge influx of federal money, a return basically coming from other states, mm-hmm. where maybe the sort of benefits are a lot more generous.
Right.
I mean, this is a transfer from other states to Oklahoma, but by rejecting it, basically we lose that benefit.
Right. We're missing out on a really important opportunity to take better care of Oklahomans that don't currently have care. And in so doing, we're taking better care of residents of other states and missing out on an influx not only of dollars that will go into our healthcare system, but go into the health of Oklahomans. We know that having access to care improves people's health. It improves their financial situation, but it also creates jobs. We have more people needing primary care. That is a significant economic activity that we are going to miss out on, given the governor's decision.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the cost issue, because opponents of the expansion keep talking about the cost. You know, there are real no guarantees beyond, say, around 2021 or 2022, 2023, as far as how much of the money the federal government's going to put up. Does that change the equation down the road for the state? If we were to accept it and all of a sudden...
Right. Well, there is a guarantee in the sense that the statute is written as such, and that's the guarantee. After 2020, the federal government will continue to pick up 90% of the tab. We can never know anything for sure. Perhaps potentially something could happen. The federal budget could be drastically restructured. There could be major changes down the road. If those changes do happen, the state can pivot and reorient itself. There's no reason to make decisions now, really crucial cost-benefit decisions where the choice is clear. This benefits Oklahoma, absolutely. Not expanding Medicaid causes much more harm fiscally and to our health. So those sort of long-term considerations, I don't mean to minimize them. They're definitely on the horizon, and we should consider them. But there's no need to put the cart before the horse, and we can make those decisions if there is restructuring the federal budget when the time comes. There's no reason this hamstrings us and leaves us on the hook for spending that we can't afford. We can easily, unhook ourselves if that becomes the case.
Kate Ritchie is a policy analyst with the Oklahoma Policy Institute. You can learn more at okpolicy.org. So we discuss Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon's decision that the state will not expand Medicaid or create a health care exchange under the provisions of the Affordable Care Act. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Barry Friedman.
My rabbi is retiring in a few months. It seems odd to say that, the my part, for there are about 2,100 Jews in Tulsa. Really, that's all there is. And I'd say about 2,045 of them have closer relationships with Rabbi Sherman than I do. On that point, though, when many in the congregation through the years would complain about getting nothing out of the service, he would always say, well, what do you bring to it? So let me start in the middle. 10, 12 years ago, and he's been at Temple Israel about 35, Rabbi Sherman had a heart bypass surgery. He said there was a biblical precept that clergy who experienced such things had to talk about them. And he did. In his first sermon back, he said, "When I was being wheeled into surgery, I didn't feel the need that I had to tell my wife and children how much I love them. They know. They know." I thought then, I think now, how do you get to that point in your life where the most important things in it are also the most secure? After his surgery, he grew a beard, which gave him an old-world Jewish Bible look. You call it the Old Testament. There was no computer in his office, no iPhone, no tennis racket. There are instead big, heavy books and pictures of family and congregants, including one of a professional wrestler he bar mitzvahed. Our dealings? I've been married twice. He married me once. "To have a Jewish wedding, you need two Jews," he said about his decision not to officiate at the first one. "You don't have two Jews." It took me about 20 years to forgive him. I probably should have told him I was angry. For many in Tulsa, not just Jews, he is the face of Judaism, but it's more than that. He has a deep friendship with Reverend Muzan Biggs of Boston Avenue Methodist Church, who is also retiring. And Rabbi Sherman reminds Jews they are not merely guests in this community, but part of it, and responsible for it. He's also a Pittsburgh Steelers fan who wants Roethlisberger to stay off motorcycles. Temple Israel has a huge red wall. It's disconcerting, but it's also reassuring. When the sun's out, rays of light streaming through the stained glass windows, the windows covered in Stars of David, and dissect the massiveness of the red. It's mesmerizing. On the bima, the stage to the rabbi's right, there was something else too. 4 years ago, there was a faded picture of my son at his memorial service. To a congregation and a family, about a boy in a frame he barely knew, the rabbi said, "Those who don't have a problem with life will never really fully understand those who do." I sit in the sanctuary. All I see is that red wall. All I see is my son. Moses, Rabbi Sherman once said, was a great leader, a great servant to God, but a terrible father, an absentee husband. I asked him, "How do you know if you're getting too busy for your own life? How do you know if you're doing that?" And he said, "Ask your wife, ask your kids." Kids, children. There was a sermon he gave, and I'm not going to do it justice, I'll tell you right now, but it was one of those moments that brought me closer to something, maybe not to God, maybe not to religion or faith, but something, maybe myself, anywhere. Here it is. A father and a son have an argument so bad the son leaves home. For years, they don't talk, but then the son hears his father is sick, so he writes him a letter saying he'd like to come home. He says in the letter, "Dad, I can't hear your voice, not yet, so I will take the train. If you want to see me, there's an oak tree at the station. Tie a handkerchief on one of the branches. If I see it when the train pulls into the station, I'll get off. If not, I'll keep riding." So the day comes, and the son is on the train sitting next to a man to whom he tells the entire story. And as the train pulls into the station, the son says, "Would you look out the window and tell me if there's a handkerchief tied to a branch of an oak tree?" The man looks and says, "No, there's not. There are hundreds of them." I don't have to tell the rabbi how much that sermon, how much he changed my life. He knows.
Barry Friedman is a regular commentator to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. Tomorrow, Studio Tulsa will not be heard. We'll be featuring two Thanksgiving specials, Lynn Rosetta Casper's Turkey Confidential, tomorrow from 10 to noon, and at 7, Giving Thanks. We'll be back with the best of Studio Tulsa on Friday. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.